This is the Bible Book Club. I'm Heather.
And I'm Susan.
And we're in the book of 1 Samuel.
Welcome to the club.
Well, in chapter 25, Samuel, the judge, prophet, and priest, died, leaving a gaping spiritual hole in the nation of Israel. Then, David had his second test of temptation in the wilderness. It was a temptation to avenge himself for the insults of a foolish man named Nabal. Nabal refused to provide David and his men food and insinuated that they were defectors. So David was going to kill him until God used a wise and beautiful woman named Abigail to stop him in his tracks. Her words turned him back to God's plan, and he was spared of making a bloody mistake. Just days later, though, Nabal dies. And upon hearing this, David takes Abigail as his wife. We want to applaud this move because they seem like a great match, but Abigail is the third of what will become eight wives of David's. And the taking of wives was a warning from Moses in Deuteronomy. This crack in David's heart for the Lord does not bode well for the future.
All right, in this episode, David will face his third and final test in the wilderness. This last test is a temptation like the first to avoid suffering. Specifically, another temptation to kill Saul and end his torturous time in the wilderness. Scene one, David's final wilderness test. Saul is back at it. His remorse outside the cave was very short-lived. He is chasing David again with 3,000 men in circles, it seems, because he goes again to the snitchy Ziphites for intel on David's location.
Chapter 26. The Ziphites went to Saul at Gibeah and said, "Is not David hiding on the hill of Hakilah, which faces Jeshimon?" So Saul went down to the desert of Ziph with his 3,000 select Israelite troops to search there for David. Saul made his camp beside the road on the hill of Hakilah facing Jeshimon, but David stayed in the wilderness. When he saw that Saul had followed him there, he sent out scouts and learned that Saul had definitely arrived.
So Saul's movements are no secret. He's traveling with this huge army, but David doesn't like to sit around. So he sends out scouts for the details of Saul's arrival, and then he goes out himself to take a look.
Verse 5. Then David set out and went to the place where Saul had camped. He saw where Saul and Abner, son of Ner, the commander of the army, had lain down. Saul was lying inside the camp with the army encamped around him. David then asked Ahimelech the Hittite and Abishai, son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, "Who will go down to the camp with me to Saul?" "I'll go with you," said Abishai. So David and Abishai went to the army by night, and there was Saul, lying asleep inside the camp with his spear stuck in the ground near his head. Abner and the soldiers were lying around him. Abishai said to David, "Today, God has delivered your enemy into your hands. Now, let me pin him to the ground with one thrust of the spear. I won't strike him twice." But David said to Abishai, "Don't destroy him. Who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? As surely as the Lord lives," he said, "the Lord himself will strike him, or his time will come and he will die, or he will go into battle and perish. But the Lord forbid that I should lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. Now, get the spear and water jug that are near his head and let's go." So David took the spear and water jug near Saul's head and they left. No one saw or knew about it, nor did anyone wake up. They were all sleeping because the Lord had put them into a deep sleep.
David passes this test to kill Saul without a moment's hesitation. He puts God's plan before his own comfort, resisting the temptation to circumvent his suffering in the wilderness and fast forward his path to the crown by killing Saul. His faith in God's justice has been strengthened. He confidently informs Abishai that Saul's life is in God's hands. God could do a couple things here. He could strike Saul down if he wanted him dead. After all, God struck Nabal down in the last episode. Or God could have Saul killed in battle. This was a prophetic statement that will kind of sort of play out in chapter 31. But it was also disconcertingly dark that David mentions this idea because he will use it and it will reappear in 2 Samuel. However, the death that takes place won't be God at work. It will be David at work. David will borrow the idea to have someone killed in battle in the story of his greatest sin, the sin of murder. David will arrange for Uriah's death in battle in an attempt to cover up his adultery and marry Uriah's wife, Bathsheba. All right, back to this story. David and Abishai grab two proofs of their nocturnal visit to Saul. They take the king's spear and a water jug. Now, the spear was most likely taken because it was a royal symbol. Usually, it was planted in the ground near wherever the king was. It was also what Saul had thrown at David to kill him on multiple occasions in court. So it's kind of a message to Saul that he's never going to kill David with this thing. So give it up. And the water jug was taken most likely to prove how close they were to Saul's head. The water jug was usually right by the bed if somebody got thirsty at night, because of course they're kind of in the desert, it's hot. Now, the combination of the two souvenirs sends a message to Saul that they were so close to him as he slept that they could have easily plunged that spear right through his head. The whole visit was successful only because it says the Lord had put everyone in a deep sleep, allowing David and Abishai the opportunity to slip in and out of the camp. Certainly, this would have been a surreal experience for David and Abishai, walking through a camp of 3,000 where not one person stirred. It should have also been a divine warning to Saul and all of the Israelites. God himself keeps intervening on David's behalf, and he makes that very clear. They cannot win in their mission to kill David. God is on his side.
Verse 13. Then David crossed over to the other side and stood on top of the hill some distance away. There was a wide space between them. He called out to the army and to Abner, son of Ner, "Aren't you going to answer me, Abner?" Abner replied, "Who are you who calls to the king?" David said, "You're a man, aren't you? And who is like you in Israel? Why didn't you guard your lord the king? Someone came to destroy your lord the king. What you have done is not good. As surely as the Lord lives, you and your men must die because you did not guard your master, the Lord's anointed. Look around you. Where are the king's spear and water jug that were near his head?"
So David is kind of taunting the entire army here. He once again tries to prove his innocence, providing proof for everyone to see. He so desperately cares what Saul thinks and what people think about him. David, in his conversation with Abner, is mocking them. Abner is supposed to be protecting Saul, and David is supposed to be trying to kill Saul, is what they're all supposed to think. But Abner did not protect Saul, and David did not kill Saul. So who is the righteous one here? It's David. David did the right thing. Abner did not. Therefore, David proclaims to Saul that it is Abner who should die, not him.
Verse 17. Saul recognized David's voice and said, "Is that your voice, David, my son?" David replied, "Yes, it is, my lord the king." And he added, "Why is my lord pursuing his servant? What have I done, and what wrong am I guilty of? Now, let my lord the king listen to his servant's words. If the Lord has incited you against me, then may he accept an offering. If, however, people have done it, may they be cursed before the Lord. They have driven me today from my share in the Lord's inheritance and have said, 'Go serve other gods.' Now, do not let my blood fall on the ground far from the presence of the Lord. The king of Israel has come out to look for a flea as one hunts a partridge in the mountains."
Again, this is the second time Saul has said, "Is that your voice, David, my son?" He just sounds so clueless. In fact, Saul sounds increasingly less like a leader and David increasingly more like a leader. David makes his case. He accuses Saul of unjustly keeping him from his right as an Israelite. He is being denied his inheritance in the promised land, and he is being driven from God's presence and forced to live where false gods are worshipped outside of the land of Israel. David also asserts that Saul is unfairly pursuing him. Saul has come out to kill a flea. David's implying that he himself is harmless to Saul. And the king is as one who hunts a partridge in the mountains, which is a play on Hebrew. Abner said in verse 14, "Who are you who calls to the king?" Now, the Hebrew word for partridge is literally "he who calls on the mountain." And remember, David is calling to them from a mountain, implying that he is the partridge. This is ironic because the fate of the partridge was to be pursued by the fowler. And David is kind of insinuating Saul's the fowler and David is the partridge.
Continuing in verse 21. Then Saul said, "I have sinned. Come back, David, my son, because you considered my life precious today. I will not try to harm you again. Surely I have acted like a fool and have been terribly wrong."
Saul has what appears to be another lucid moment and realizes what a fool he has been. He asks David again to come back and promises not to harm him. One has to wonder, is Saul lying? Or was this more mental illness on his part? However, he does state a fact. Saul is a fool. And here he finally admits it. Which, following the story of Nabal, the fool in chapter 25, the author is clearly making a point. Saul is like Nabal. Now, the word fool is only used three times in 1 Samuel. In chapter 13, verse 13, Samuel describes Saul's disobedience as a foolish thing.
"You have done a foolish thing," Samuel said. "You have not kept the command the Lord your God gave you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time."
Then in chapter 25, verse 25, Nabal is described as a fool.
"Please pay no attention, my Lord, to that wicked man, Nabal. He is just like his name. His name means fool, and folly goes with him."
And here in chapter 26, Saul admits,
"Surely I have acted like a fool and have been terribly wrong."
So Samuel tells Saul he's foolish. Then Nabal is described as a fool, and then Saul admits he's a fool. So when we look back, we can see that this is a theme we have encountered over and over since Saul was introduced. Saul has had multiple scenes where he is portrayed foolishly. We met Saul chasing donkeys before he was anointed king. Saul danced naked when he first started chasing David and the Lord was trying to stop him. Saul publicly relieved himself in the cave, looking quite foolish in front of all of David's men. And then Saul sleeps surrounded by guards who fail to protect him, which makes him, again, look like his whole army's foolish. Saul was the king the people wanted, but the people were foolish and they made a foolish choice. They did not fear the Lord as much as they idolized other cultures. They wanted a king like the world, and the world is foolish. And so God gave them a foolish king. David was the king God wanted because he had a heart for the Lord. He sought wisdom. And that's the point God is trying to make. We want foolish things. The world wants foolish things. And if we are like the world, we will choose foolishly. And they chose a king that looked like the rest of the world.
And so for us, our goal should be to emulate David and not Saul.
Exactly. David was the king God wanted because he had a heart for the Lord. He sought wisdom. David was persecuted and deeply hurt by Saul's foolish behavior. Perhaps because of that, David is going to make sure his son Solomon learns the difference between wisdom and foolishness. Therefore, it's not surprising that Solomon wrote more about foolishness in the book of Proverbs than in any other book. In fact, the book of Proverbs, which mentions fools 72 times, opens with these words.
"The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, for gaining wisdom and instruction, for understanding the words of insight, for receiving instruction in prudent behavior, doing what is right and just and fair, for giving prudence to those who are simple, knowledge and discretion to the young. Let the wise listen and add to their learning, and let the discerning get guidance. For understanding proverbs and parables, the sayings and riddles of the wise. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction."
David was not perfect. In 2 Samuel and in 1 Chronicles, David is going to admit to having done a foolish thing. But I had to believe that after watching Saul behave so foolishly, David desperately wanted to teach his son all he could about wisdom. And that is why Solomon wrote about it so much. I think. I can't prove that, but that's what I think. He learned from his father, and it is the one thing Solomon asked God for in 1 Kings 3 verse 3.
The Lord appeared to Solomon during the night in a dream, and God said, "Ask for whatever you want me to give you." Solomon answered, "You have shown great kindness to your servant, my father David, because he was faithful to you and righteous and upright in heart. You have continued this great kindness to him and have given him a son to sit on his throne this very day. Now, Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of my father David. But I am only a little child and do not know how to carry out my duties. Your servant is here among the people you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to count or number. So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who is able to govern this great people of yours?"
The entire book of Proverbs theme points to wisdom. It is a book describing the importance of living wisely and in the fear of the Lord, as opposed to following the seductive path of foolishness. So here we go again with a reference to the path. We are all on a path, and we have choices between right and wrong, between good and evil. And we're going to put that diagram of the path to good and evil in the show notes again.
Now back to our story in 1 Samuel chapter 26, verse 22. "Here is the king's spear," David answered. "Let one of your young men come over and get it. The Lord rewards everyone for their righteousness and faithfulness. The Lord delivered you into my hands today, but I would not lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. As surely as I value your life today, so may the Lord value my life and deliver me from all trouble." Then Saul said to David, "May you be blessed, David, my son. You will do great things and surely triumph." So David went on his way and Saul returned home.
Saul has these momentary moments where he sees the truth. It's so bizarre.
Does he even realize what he said just then?
I know he doesn't. He doesn't, I don't think. Well, David ignores Saul's invitation to return to court and returns the spear to Saul. Saul blesses David and tells him prophetically that he will do great things, which we know he will. Then David leaves and Saul goes home. This is the last Saul will ever see of David. Saul's end is truly drawing near. David was tempted three times to become the fool that Saul had become. And David resisted the temptation and instead became like Christ. David states, "The Lord rewards everyone for their righteousness and faithfulness." Living in the wilderness, chased by his very own father-in-law, David stood firm in his belief that God would reward him. What do you believe? It is so hard to make the right choices today. But right choices lead to righteousness, and righteousness leads to reward. In Matthew 5, Jesus ends the Beatitudes with this verse.
"Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you."
It is a great reminder to us that those rewards don't always come during our time on earth, but will be there for us in heaven. David was persecuted and stood firm in his faith that God would work all things together for his good, even in the wilderness, and that he would be rewarded if he was obedient to God's plan, something Saul was not. What about you? Can you stand firm? Do you believe what David believed? Is your faith great enough to carry you through persecution? Scene 2. David leaves the wilderness for Philistia. Just because David stood firm in his faith does not mean that he could see what was coming and how this would all end. And it does not mean that he did not get discouraged in the waiting. He often despaired, and we can hear it in his words in the Psalms, and we can't blame him. No matter how hard David tries to prove his innocence to Saul, in his heart, he knew it was hopeless. Saul's coherent moment of kindness to David in this last few verses will be followed by Saul's incoherent thoughts of murder. Imagine David's frustration. He can do nothing to change the situation. He has tried, but he cannot see the end to all of this. David is not encouraged by Saul's blessing, Quite the opposite. He sounds frustrated.
1 Samuel chapter 27. But David thought to himself, "One of these days I will be destroyed by the hand of Saul. The best thing I can do is to escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul will give up searching for me anywhere in Israel, and I will slip out of his hand." So David and the 600 men with him left and went over to Achish, son of Maok, king of Gath. David and his men settled in Gath with Achish. Each man had his family with him, and David had his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail of Carmel, the widow of Nabal. When Saul was told that David had fled to Gath, he no longer searched for him.
Saul's persecution was so relentless and hostile that David felt it was safer to live among Israel's arch enemy than his very own people. David leaves the wilderness knowing Saul cannot afford to pursue him in Philistia. He moves his two wives, his 600 men, and their wives into enemy territory. One has to wonder, so this is just a side note here. One has to wonder if Abigail was aware of the irony of her situation. With her first marriage, she had a foolish husband, but lived in wealth and stability. With her second marriage, she has a wise, godly husband, but lives in poverty and danger. She was trapped in the first marriage and hunted in the second, a hostage in one and a fugitive in the other. On top of all that, Abigail is the third wife with a very complicated household hierarchy looming in the future. I just can't help wishing Abigail had gotten top billing in David's life instead of Bathsheba, because I love her.
So she's the third wife, but he moved his two wives, and that's because yes. Michal is still back with Saul.
Correct. And Saul had given her to another man, which I could do a deep dive on, because a lot of the Jewish authors of today write, this is really a side note, that Michal never really had a physical relationship with this other husband because she's going to come back.
Mm-hmm. She does come back.
She comes back. So, and that
she was in love with him.
Well, it was kind of, yeah, I'm going to dig deeper into it. Cause I was in my research. I touched on it when we were going through it, but we're going to come back to Michal and I'm going to do more research on her, from some of the Jewish writers.
Can't wait. All right. Back to David.
Who is house hunting for 600.
Verse 5. Then David said to Achish, "If I have found favor in your eyes, let a place be assigned to me in one of the country towns that I may live there. Why should your servant live in the royal city with you?" So on that day, Achish gave him Ziklag, and it has belonged to the kings of Judah ever since. David lived in Philistine territory a year and 4 months.
All right, so David's looking for a place for his people to live. You know, they've been traveling in the wilderness, and he's like, "We're going to Philistia, and I'm going to make this work." Ziklag was allocated to the tribe of Judah by Joshua way back in Joshua chapter 15, but it was never successfully conquered. So this is a perfect place for David to live, as he is from the tribe of Judah, and it kind of says that from David's life on, this was a territory for the tribe of Judah. So way to go for him. He's acting like Israel's king. The move to Ziklag solidifies David's exile. He's living as a foreigner, serving a foreign king. Achish is the king of Gath. Now remember, Gath is one of the five principal cities of the Philistines. Each city has its own lord or king. And Gath is also the city that Goliath was from. David's profession is military leader at this time. So he hires himself out to Achish and in return receives a place for his army to live in Ziklag. It's a good deal. David is providing, however, this is funny, similar services to Achish, the king of Gath, as he had provided to Nabal. Remember when he was protecting Nabal's territory? Now, it never says that Achish is a fool. However, remember back in chapter 21, when David first started running from Saul, he ran to Gath at that time. And the Philistine people told King Achish about David being in the area, because remember, David had just killed Goliath shortly before then. So to protect himself, David acted like he was insane as a way of escape. King Achish fell for it, thinking David was insane, and let David go, saying he had enough crazy people and he didn't care for more. So he never really prosecuted David. But here we are, and now Achish is hiring David, the man he earlier released because he was crazy, to protect him and work as a military guy for him.
Do you think he realizes that it's the same person?
It's got to. He was famous. He killed Goliath, which makes Achish appear rather foolish, kind of like Nabal, like just blown about on the wind, whatever hits him. Oh, yeah, come work for me and protect me with your army. But, a few years ago, I thought you were a crazy, insane person. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. Who hires a crazy person to, like, defend him? So let's compare Achish, the Philistine, to Nabal, the Israelite. Nabal, David's very own kinsman, rejected his protection, scorned him, and denied him and his men food. While Achish, David's enemy, appreciated his protection, respected him, and rewarded he and his men with a place to live. Achish may be a fool, but Nabal, the Israelite, looks worse.
Can I make an observation real quick?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
I think it's cool. So you said before Ziklag was allocated to the tribe of Judah in Joshua chapter 15,
mm-hmm.
but they never conquered it.
Right.
It was conquered by the Philistines.
Right.
So now we're back in this area. David is gifted.
What should have been theirs.
What should have been theirs to yes. begin with.
Yeah.
It made me think about the parallel between even us and here. We are living on God's creation, but we still feel like this isn't our home because it doesn't belong to us yet.
Oh, that's a good one.
You know
one.
What I mean? And
yeah.
So there's going to be a day when God conquers all of it again and gifts it to his people as his perfect creation.
My mind is exploding.
Yeah.
Bible bender.
So I just thought that was cool. Even in his exile to something that historically should be theirs,
mm-hmm.
there's still this element of this is not our home,
mm-hmm.
but one day it will be. Mm-hmm. One day all of this will be ours again,
mm-hmm.
and God's creation will be restored
mm-hmm.
and even better.
I love that Bible vendor. And I loved thinking of David acting like a king. Even when he's not yet king, like he's taking back territory. He's doing what Saul didn't do, mm-hmm. even though he's like living in exile. All right. Scene 3, David deceives the Philistines.
Verse 8. Now David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites, Gerzites, and Amalekites. From ancient times, these people had lived in the land extending to Shur and Egypt. Whenever David attacked an area, he did not leave a man or woman alive, but took sheep and cattle, donkeys and camels and clothes. Then he returned to Achish. When Achish asked, "Where did you go raiding today?" David would say, "Against the Negev of Judah," or "Against the Negev of Jerahmeel," or "Against the Negev of the Kenites." He did not leave a man or woman alive to be brought to Gath, for he thought they might inform on us and say, "This is what David did." And such was his practice as long as he lived in the Philistine territory. Achish trusted David and said to himself, "He has become so obnoxious to his people, the Israelites, that he will be my servant for life."
This is so important. David is doing more for the Israelites in exile than Saul is doing as king. In Israel, David is so clever and he has found a way to be loyal to God and Israel no matter where he lives. David and his men are mercenaries. They're professional soldiers hired to kill, but they are playing a trick on their employer. They have been hired by their enemy, the Philistines, to kill the Israelites. But in good faith, David cannot fortify the Philistines against God and Israel. So thinking like a future king, he turns the Philistines' investment in him into a profit for Israel. He reports to Achish in verse 10 that he raided Judah, Jehameel, and Kenite, all Israelite tribes, when in fact, he raided Israelites' enemies, the Geshurites, Gerzites, and Amalekites, all Canaanites, that God had commanded Israel to drive from the promised land years ago. I love him. The irony is that in this well-played deception, David fulfills God's commands to kill the Canaanites while tricking the Philistines to pay him for it. The other irony here is a contrast between David and Saul. Note that one of the nations that David is raiding is the Amalekites. Why did God anoint David? Because Saul failed to obey God and destroy the Amalekites in 1 Samuel 15. Remember, Saul kept their livestock and the king of Agag when Samuel had told him to kill them. Saul disobeyed, and so the kingdom was torn from him. What Saul could not do, David does so well. Saul could not resist learning about the fascinating and wealthy culture of King Agag. He loved the culture of the world. So Saul didn't kill Agag, even though he was commanded to. And yet here is David, forced to live in the lost culture, and he still finds a way to please God.
So King Achish must not have been a great king, though, because even Saul, who was not a good king, had spies. And would have known that David had deceived him, that he didn't really conquer the people that he was saying he conquered?
So I agree with you. It seems kind of funny that David kills all these people, but it did specifically say that David was careful. He raids these areas and he kills everybody, so nobody can really say what happened. But anybody could have gone and seen he killed the wrong little city here. This is not one of our enemies. But you know, these weren't Philistine cities. They were other cultures. So who really went there and looked? I don't know. All right, the question for us is, who are you more like, Saul or David? Are you conforming to the culture like Saul? Are you attracted to the culture like Saul? Is it irresistible to you? Or are you able to resist it like David, who was forced to live in it, but still resist it? And like David, can we find a way to please God even when we're living in a lost culture? Which today we are. We're living in the world and it's hard.
What's a club without friends? If you're enjoying the Bible Book Club, why don't you share it? And then you can say,
Welcome to the club.
New episodes drop every Monday, and get all episodes now on Amazon Music. As always, head over to susanmee.com/Bible Book Club for show notes from today's episode. Bible Book Club is hosted by Susan Merrill and Heather Rubio, edited by Buck Buchanan, produced by Haley Mawat.